When David Banner met Maggie Shaw, it was the love they'd both been looking for. But she didn't know his secret. She didn't know that his danger would become her danger. Their life together was threatened. David Banner had been pushed too far.
You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
He's mean and green, and after 6 years, the Hulk will face his greatest challenge ever. Because this time, he's fighting for love. Bill Bigby and Lou Ferrigno are the Incredible Hulk. If the Incredible Hulk returns.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And before we all head off to see Thor Ragnarok, I thought it was appropriate for us to talk about the first time the Incredible Hulk met the mighty Thor in live action. And that, of course, would be the 1988 TV movie, The Incredible Hulk Returns. And joining me to talk about it is my old pal, Corey Drew. Hi, Corey.
This is my Fire and Water with Rob Kelly world premiere.
It is. You and I have known each other, I don't know, like 10 years now, but yet you've been on Siskoid's Give Me Those Star Trek show a bunch of times. I don't know how that really happened. Never rub another man's rhubarb, but I'm happy to finally have you here on the show.
Wait, in this scenario, am I your rhubarb or is Siskoid? Like,
we'll leave that up to the listener's imagination. So, the Incredible Hulk returns, Corey. Why did you want to talk about this wonderful TV movie?
It's one of those things that for the longest time, like, I didn't really forget that it existed, but it was like, it was always just sort of in the back of my head as this like fun thing from when I was significantly younger. And it's just sort of there. And I think like with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it's every now and again, it's important to remember your roots.
It's true. You have to remember, for those of you that are too young to remember these kinds of movies, this was all we had. This was it.
Yeah.
This aired on May 22nd, 1988. I remember watching it live, I watched it that night. And it was so exciting because, I grew up on the Incredible Hulk TV show. I loved it. But I was always frustrated by the fact that the Hulk was so, earthbound. He was always just fighting mobsters and crooks and the occasional wild bear or something like that. But, he never took on the Rhino or the Leader or Zax or the Abomination. He had to do any of that fun stuff. So this was the first time the Incredible Hulk live-action movie was going to, enter into the Marvel Universe. It was really exciting.
Right. It was. And it was – it's the first time any sort of air quotes real – fantasy sci-fi element beyond, the hulking out actually entered into the show, to my recollection anyway.
Yeah, this was really the beginning of that, and it was really, really cool. I mean, the plot, such as it is, of course, the Incredible Hulk TV series ran from 1977 through 1982. It never got a final episode. CBS just canceled it. So they never got a chance to even resolve the story. The show all of a sudden wasn't on the air anymore. But, I mean, this movie opens. It's directed by Nicholas Correa, who was a veteran of the TV show. It was co-written by Bill Bixby himself and produced by Bill Bixby. It's 6 years later, and David Banner, now doing business as David Banyan, always with the DB, this guy, is working at the Joshua Lambert Institute, and he's in a relationship with Dr. Maggie Shaw, played by Lee Purcell. He is happy and content, so much so that he has not turned into the Hulk in over 2 years. Banner/Banyan is part of a team that is working on a gamma transponder. Late one night, Banner is subjecting himself to the machine in hopes it will cure him of his affliction forever. But he is interrupted by a former student, Dr. Don Blake, who recognized the long-thought-dead David Banner and has an unbelievable story of his own. A while back, during an expedition to Norway, Blake discovered an ancient tomb that housed a magical hammer, which contains the soul of Thor, an immortal warrior banished to Earth by Odin. Thor is such a hothead that when Blake summons him, it brings the Hulk out in Banner and they briefly engage in a fight. Later, a criminal outfit inside the Institute gets the idea to steal the transponder and kidnap Banner. When that doesn't work, they turn their attention on Dr. Shaw, hoping to use her to force Banner to do what they want. Hulk and Thor reluctantly have to team up to try and get Shaw and the transponder back. Now, did you watch this when it aired?
I sure did. I recorded it. In fact, I watched it the night that it aired. I recorded it, diligently pausing at the beginning and end of each commercial break. I kept that I have that VHS tape to this day, and I rewatched it numerous times.
I mean, you know, okay, I with the benefit of hindsight, many years hindsight, and 20 years worth of or 20 Marvel movies that we've all been able to enjoy, like, you know, this thing. Okay, it's a really noble effort. It's just, you know, really they had no money to spend here, and it was kind of ambitious for them to A, introduce any new character from the Marvel universe, but to do Thor of all things, like it yeah, really are really kind of biting off more than they can chew, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, in fairness, they didn't actually do Thor; they did Donald Blake and, you know, the Asgardian guardian god of surfing,
right.
And they completely, you know, that's absurd. They didn't completely ignore everything that had been written in the comic books about Thor, but there was a, you know, they made him fit what they needed, I guess, in that particular instance. And, you know, so we didn't have to deal with him, you know, summoning the Rainbow Bridge and, you know, all of those things that you might, that I secretly, as a, you know, not secretly, quite verbally as a child, I was really hoping he would do.
Right. I mean, like, the hammer isn't magical. You know, anybody
no,
can pick
anybody
it
can
up.
Lift it.
Yeah, anybody can lift it. Eric Allen Kramer plays Thor. And, you know, I think he's fine. He kind of plays Thor as a big meathead. Steve Levitt plays Dr. Donald Blake. He was in another. Ironically enough, Steve Levitt was in a movie earlier called Hunk, where he transforms
yeah.
into a giant hunk, kind of like a handsome guy. So he and right. and Eric Allen Kramer was
yeah.
later in a movie called High School High, where he played a character called Hulk. So these two.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think of their take on Thor? I mean, as you said, it's not the comic book Thor at all. His costume doesn't look anything like it, and it's basically they're kind of like perfect strangers. That's sort of the mentality they got going here. But what did you think of their version of Thor?
You know, initially after rewatching it, after many, many years of not having watched it, I was just kind of like, this is not all right. But then by the end of the film, I was like, you know, he's really charismatic. Like, I actually genuinely enjoyed this iteration of Thor. You know, he's no Beta Ray Bill, but, you know, he's got that, you know, he really, you know, I enjoyed him. And I enjoyed Donald Blake, such as it was, but, you know, it is very much a the Perfect Strangers reference is spot on. It's very much a creature of its time. It's a very 80s sort of take on them. You know, the sequence where they go to the roadhouse in, you know,
right.
wherever they are, Southern California somewhere, and they go to the roadhouse and he like pounds beers with bikers and, you know, everybody loves him. And it was just a very like kind of 80s movie moment. Like, it wouldn't have happened in any other decade.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that this was obviously meant as a potential pilot, you know, for a Thor
right.
TV series. And as much as I like that scene that you're just talking about, it really does stop the movie cold. Because all of a sudden, they're like, the Hulk just disappears out of his own movie, and we've
right.
spent 20 minutes with Thor parting, and you're like, whoa, this was literally the clip reel they would have used to pitch it. You know, like, here we go, let's do Thor, Friday nights at 9, you know, there's your series.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene later on where the reporter, Jack Colvin, Jack McGee, played by Jack Colvin, of course, another holdover from the series, he visits the apartment because there's when news of the big Hulk Thor fight happens, and it, you know, he picks up the trail again. He's like, oh, the, you know, this thing I've been following my whole career, and now it's started up again. And he goes and he finds the apartment, and he's the door is answered by Thor, and he's shirtless, and he's got the big flagon of mead or whatever, and, you know, he's like, I'm looking for a man. Found you have one, you know. And he's like, I'm looking for a particular man. You have found a particular man. I mean, it's real goofy, but I admit, I kind of liked it too. I would have watched the Thor show if they had made one.
Sure. I mean, and, you know, I guess I was always pragmatic, because even as a kid, I remember thinking, well, the only way they're going to get this Thor show off the ground here is by making it a sitcom.
Right.
Right. Because in the 80s, that was the only thing anybody would ever greenlight, was a sitcom. And anything that was sci-fi or supernatural in any way, you know, it always had to have a a comedy end to it, which, you know, I guess is a lesson that the Marvel Entertainment and now Disney really picked up on, because
yeah, Thor Ragnarok looks like a comedy practically. So
it does. It's a funny movie.
There is a great line that Don Blake has when he is talking to David Banner. I love that initially that David Banner's like, you suffered under a delusion, Donald. This didn't really happen to you. And then he's like, okay, I'll show you. And he gets out the hammer. But he has that great line where he says, Thor can only be brought forth for a good cause. And he goes, this is the 80s. I don't know what a good cause is anymore.
I had actually written that exact line down on my notes. Yeah, that was fantastic. I love that little social commentary, you know, in that moment. I was really struck by how, you know, David Banner was really like, I mean, he was just like a human decaf cup of coffee. Like everything about him was just like so like 80s sensitive new age man, like the big collared white, you know, robe that he's wearing, and or maybe it was a sweater, I don't recall, but and you know, he was just like such a you know, he was that character, that sensitive, thoughtful, intelligent, caring, but very unapproachable person. And I liked that aspect of it, because again, I think that's something that, you know, that's kind of a character that's kind of gone away, you know, in films. And it's sort of interesting to see that again. But then to have that commentary about, I don't know what a good cause is anymore in the 80s. And for me to just be watching it now in 2017, and I'm like, well, what would you do now?
Yeah, think,
oh,
think,
the halcyon days of that. You know?
Yeah, oh, yeah, you think Reaganomics is bad. Well, okay, yeah. Don. Yeah, you're right about David Banner, or Bruce Banner, whatever you want to call him. Because, yeah, he's definitely – Bill Bixby's take on the character was definitely in that Alan Alda kind of mold.
Exactly.
Of the sensitive guy. And, you know, it opens up – the movie opens with him having a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he can't tell his girlfriend – you know, what's going on, and he makes vague references to the monster. And of course, you know, she's taking him kind of not literally. She's just thinking, you know, he's got a wild side. And of course, we know what he's literally saying. Now, I love,
right.
You know, it's interesting. Like he wants to cure himself, of course. And that's why he's hanging around with the gamma transponder. But I mean, he does say, I have not turned into the Hulk in over 2 years. Like, it seems like things are going pretty well. I don't know if I would mess with it. You know what I mean? Like, the girlfriend's got a really nice beach house. She's got a nice dog. I mean, I think I'd be like, right. I think things are pretty good. I don't think I'd strap myself into the gamma transponder on their off chance something could go wrong.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, the flip side to that would be, I guess, you know, the nice dog and the nice house and, you know, the nice life could all be torn apart, and, you know, if he burns himself well.
That's,
you know,
true,
making
yeah.
his decaf coffee. So, I mean, I guess the flip side to that is that, you know, that's his, that, you know, that there's that. But, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up, though, because he doesn't, like, he does an awful lot of talking in this movie, like, where, you know, the writers, I guess, thought, this sounds really coy. And I'm watching it thinking, you just told her you're the Hulk. Like, you literally just, and she's talking, like, when you're watching it, the way she responds to him, it feels very much like she's in on his secret. It, you know, like it starts off like he's being coy and not trying to reveal too much. But then, like the conversation that they're having, it really does sound like she knows what the deal is. And then later on in the movie, when he, you know, when basically it's revealed to her what's going on in no uncertain terms, she's just totally nonplussed. So, you know, I don't know if I'm reading into it or if it was a choice on their part as, you know, thespians, that she did know, you know, and the whole time. And it was just, you know, because she is supposed to be smart, like
right.
really,
she's,
really
she's
smart.
She's a scientist, too. That's where they met, is at this institute. So,
not that she sciences at any point in the film.
No.
But we are told that she is, you know, an intellect on par with him. So, you know, like I was just sort of struck in that conversation. And then again, when he's talking with the people at the evil, well, I guess the corporation itself isn't that evil. It was 1988. We weren't into that yet. But,
right.
you know, the people that he works for, I mean, they just, you know, he gave them like really, really clear indications that he was shady as all get out. And they're like, no, it's cool. It's cool. You know? And I'm like, you really don't have to be that clever to go from point A to point B here, guys.
Like, they're like, luckily you're a brilliant scientist, Dr. Banyan, because you choose to work late at night after everyone else has gone home. And he's like, yes, thank you for allowing me to do that. I'm like, you know, that is something we never saw in the original TV series, is how many resumes David Banner must have to crank out, because he was constantly having to come up with, you know, the DB name, the David Barker, the David this, right. The, you know, whatever that. And it's, of course, this is pre-internet, so nobody can look him up. So he just wanders right. into town, and he's like, hey, I'm a research scientist. You guys need any sciencing? And they're like, yeah, we actually do need somebody. Like, okay, great. You know, he was really good at that. He was really good at finding right. work for an out-of-work scientist. He didn't need LinkedIn or anything. He could just show up and bam, he was employed.
Trust me, I'm good. I have no documentation to prove it.
Right.
Because I have invented this identity out of whole cloth. But I'm really good. You should trust me and hire me. And now in this movie, he actually extends that to his friend.
He gets Donald Blake a job. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. And everybody's just like, you know, apparently they did not have HR, you know, right. back in the day. It was not a thing. Like, they weren't concerned.
I actually thought it was a pretty clever conceit to have Don Blake be his student. Like, I thought that was pretty funny. And Blake sees him on the news and is like, I thought this guy was dead, because everybody of course right. thinks he's dead. I thought that was pretty clever. Like, you would, and of course Blake shows up because he wants to be cured, not cured necessarily, but he has his own unique problem. And I'm like, that's actually a pretty clever way of working Thor into this, I have to say. You know, I mean, it's like that makes a lot of sense.
I was impressed too that, you know, as a man of science, you know, Donald Blake was interested in a physics based explanation for what was going on. You know, like, he wasn't just like, I need a really smart guy. He was like, I need the best scientist I know to help me understand this. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah. And it didn't feel forced. A lot of things did feel forced. That did not feel forced.
What do you feel felt forced?
Oh, well, the exposition scene about him discovering Thor felt really forced. And I felt like the initial appearance of Thor, where he was like, you know, I mean, when Donald Blake's explaining Thor's deal, and he's like, you know, oh, he'll show up and he'll do whatever I ask him to, as long as it's legal, as long as it's in the course of, you know, doing something, a good cause, the precursor to the line that we were discussing a few minutes ago. And then Thor shows up, and he's just kind of an arrogant douche to, you know, and deliberately misunderstanding everything this much smaller man is, you know, saying to him. And it's, you know, like I get it. They need, you know, David Banyan to Hulk out. The easiest way to do that is to, you know, adhere him to an electrical panel for 15 or 20 seconds right. so that, you know, right. he, you know, for, because that's the thing that happens apparently when you grab an electrical panel, you don't let go immediately.
Very touchy equipment.
Yeah. Yeah. And grabby equipment as well. But, you know, so that whole sequence felt really forced, and the exposition scene where they're explaining the trip into the mountains, and then I went down this pathway because I was drawn there, and then I went down this pathway because I was drawn there, you know, and I was just like, okay, all right, good enough.
I do wish the initial fight between Hulk and Thor had been maybe directed with a little more style, because, like, Lou Ferrigno is not like that tall a guy. Like, I mean, okay, is he bigger than most of humanity? Yes. Yes, he is. And if you've ever met him in person, you see that he looms over. But I mean, Nicholas Correa just shoots him. Like, there's lots of shots of Hulk where there's the camera's just sort of straight on him, and there's lots of dead space on the sets around him. So the Hulk looks kind of puny compared to the bat. And it's like, you know, would it have killed you to put the camera down on the ground a little so Hulk looms over the camera just so you can get the idea that he's this massive figure? And so every time you see him standing next to Thor, you're like, well, he's really not even all that tall. I mean, he's muscular. Right. And the wig is really kind of getting crazy. But, like, I don't know. It's like, he just, considering this is the first time we've seen the Hulk in 6 years, his appearance is not all that exciting or thrilling, really. Right. It's too bad.
And throughout the film, like, most of what he does is pose, and the only time, like, he really does anything to my way of thinking, like, most of the impressive superheroics are executed by Thor.
Right.
And like, you know, Hulk does that 1970s, 80s jump down without breaking his shins into splinters thing.
Right.
Right, which is the superpower from the 70s, and the Bionic Man did it all the time. And, you know, and then he may have steered, I don't remember if he steered made a car go off on its side or something, like something to that effect.
Yeah, but mostly he just
screamed and posed.
Right.
Which, you know, is an effective use of Lou Ferrigno's physique, but it's not the most exciting thing to watch.
No, I mean, he said it's a lot of him running off. And I mean, that was when I was a kid. That was something that was so frustrating about the Hulk TV show, because it was like the Hulk was in it so minimally. And of course, the guy that created the Hulk TV show, Kenneth Johnson, who was not involved in these movies at all, he really wasn't a particular fan of the Hulk. I mean, he didn't have any particular, you know, affection for the character. He initially apparently wanted the Hulk to be red on the TV show, and Stan Lee was the one. Stan Lee was like, no, that's a little too much change. So he didn't come to this with any sort of grand, like, oh, we have to be true to the comic or whatever. I mean, so at least in this movie, they do make some attempts. You know, again, the Hulk, he doesn't have purple pants. He's got the blue green jeans, and he runs around. And, you know, I like that when Thor hits Hulk with the hammer, like, that really hurts Hulk. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great bit. Like, that was, and he, you know, he like holds his stomach almost like, what the hell? Because that's probably the first time Hulk's ever been hurt
surprised.
By anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, then he takes a dart later on in the film, and it makes him sleepy.
Yes.
But, you know, that didn't really bother me. Like, I mean, obviously, if you give it too much thought, it's a bit of a stretch, but it didn't really bother me, because my experience with the Hulk is that he is always ready for a nap. Like he falls asleep a lot. Like, there's a lot of panel space in a lot of animation devoted to Hulk falling asleep.
Right.
So, like, that right there just felt like true to form to me, you know, in a way that it didn't even, like, I didn't even question it until I was watching it with the intent of speaking about it. And I was like, wait a second. Mjolnir makes him go, ow.
Yeah, right.
But a dart from a helicopter puts him to sleep. What's that all about?
When the mob guys inside the institute, when they kidnap Dr. Shaw and they take away in the helicopter, it leaves Hulk and Thor to just be on the beach, just screaming to the heavens. And it's fun because that's like the best shot we have of the two of them together. But it doesn't it doesn't make them look impressive that just this puny helicopter can just get away while these two characters that we've seen in comics can, like, throw planets around are just stuck on the beach going, hurr! Like, it doesn't make them look terribly impressive.
Right. I mean, obviously, you know, with the Hulk, like, the Hulk has manifested some truly bizarre powers throughout his comic book history. And same with Thor. A helicopter obviously wouldn't be much of a challenge to them. But, you know, that's one of those things that when you're watching it, you realize, okay, how far we've come in terms of the limits of the technology. Not to divert too much away from it, but I started watching Star Trek Discovery recently. And it's, you know, there's a point where you have to accept, okay, well, the reason the tech looked that way was because that's what they could do.
Right.
You know, and this scene very much reminded me of that. Like, okay, this looks like this. This ended in this result because the limits of technology are you know, prevented us from having any other result. although, I mean, I suppose an argument could be made that also the limits of the patience of the director might have had something to do with that, too, because I'm sure that they could have downed that helicopter, but that is not what the story required.
Yeah, I mean, they probably had so little money to work with. I mean, one of the on a script level, I'm disappointed that the villains are so low rent. I mean, it's just a bunch of crooks. Now, it is run, the mob is run by Tim Thomerson, and his, like, his secondhand man is Charles Napier. The Chin Squad with those two, you know, having them in a movie together, it's like, you're just all these guys. But, like, they're kind of such boring villains, and especially right. when you realize it's a mob, it's an extortion gang versus Hulk and Thor. But right. yeah, they didn't have any money. You know, they don't – like you said, you make the allowance for – they didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have the money to do the Leader or the Rhino or the Abomination. They just did – that was never going to happen. I mean, the opening credits to this movie are the same credits as the TV show. They just slapped the word Returns
just
at the bottom.
The word Returns on it. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. So
and actually noted that to discuss.
Yeah. I mean, you know what's funny, though? Rewatching this movie, which I did for this recording, like, that opening credit sequence, man, that still works like gangbusters. That just it is does. So Very, well composed.
Yeah, it really is. And the music in that introduction, to me, like, I don't have – to be honest with you, I'm not quite old enough to have – made the Hulk TV show like a part of my regular watching. I'm of the age where my brother would lock me in my mother's bedroom while he was drinking beers with his buddies, and I would turn the Hulk on thinking I'd love it because I like superheroes, and I would kind of be afraid, you know? Like, I was like, oh, when the Hulk's out, that's kind of frightening. But that music hits like this – they just don't do it like that anymore. You know, it just hits this part of my spine that I'm like, oh – everything about that music is the close credits, you know, and
the sad, the lonely man theme. That is,
yeah,
oh my
lonely
god,
man theme, heartbreaking, and just that almost staccato piano that plays at the very beginning when he's getting into the device where he turns into the pole.
Yeah,
and it makes your heart race, and it makes your breath like it's hard to breathe when you're watching, when you're listening to that music, and it's so effective. There was no reason for them to do anything other than slap the word Returns onto the bottom of those opening credits, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch that scene where he first transforms into the Hulk and it's done at night, you realize how much more frightening the Hulk looks at night, and I'm kind of amazed that they didn't do more night scenes. I guess it's probably more expensive. But, I mean, just like that thing where you know, he's down at his grave and then he sighs and he looks at the camera and then they do the split screen and he turns into the Hulk on the other side. And it's still really terrifying. Like
it
still worked really well. And none of the scenes in this movie take place at night, except when the Hulk falls asleep, as you mentioned, he falls asleep on the beach.
And yeah, exactly.
Wakes up and the dog's licking his face and it's Bruce Banner or whatever. But yeah, I mean, they really, I don't know why they didn't have more Hulk at night, because the Hulk at night really is pretty terrifying.
At night and in the rain,
yeah,
like very frightening. And you know, I think one of the reasons why this movie kind of gets a pass from me in terms of like I recognize it for what it is, but I watch it and I still enjoy the heck out of it, is because of those things that it didn't change, those very effective things that it just sort of kept. They're like, okay, even down to Mr. McGee. Like, Mr. McGee, for me, watching the show, was always the most annoying part of the show.
Right.
Because you know, I was like, oh, just leave the Hulk alone, man. Like, he just wants to, like, you know, eat Twinkies and you know, sit alone by a butte in Utah or something.
Me too.
You know, same, right? And, you know, he was just, like, so, like, aggressively annoying, and that doesn't change in this film. Mr. McGee shows up and he's still aggressively annoying, and you know, like I feel like they were, I don't know if they were, but I feel like there was an attempt to sort of cast him as this sort of Kolchak the Night Stalker kind of guy on the trail of the Hulk.
Oh, sure, but yeah,
this never really comes off that way. He's just this kind of, I don't know, like sleazy kind of opportunistic doesn't care if, you know, the story harms anybody's life, and also not very smart. You know, he comes close to figuring things out a lot, but he never quite gets there. And as we discussed earlier, David Banner is not great at keeping his secrets.
No, again, I don't know why he's so obsessed with keeping his initials the same. Like, why do we, you know, you can just call yourself anything. Yeah. Why do you can go yourself right. Tim Smith. Why do you need to go by right. David Banyan and make it be close? So everybody's like, well, David Banner, David Banyan, that could be a thing. Yeah, I mean, the all the Marvel stuff done in the 70s, all the live action stuff is, they're almost like apologizing for the superhero element. So it's like, well, we'll just make the Hulk into the Fugitive. And occasionally there'll be a monster in it. And like the Spider-Man TV show, such as it was basically like a journalism show, like, you know, the mucker. It's like Lou Grant with a guy that occasionally dresses as Spider-Man and runs around. And like, if you've ever seen the Doctor Strange TV movie that they made, like there's big chunks of that are just like Trapper John MD. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally he casts a spell, you know, so like they were constantly like, I mean, you got to think in 1988 when this was made, the only superhero stuff that was available were the Superman movies. This was still a year out from Batman.
From Batman, it changed everything.
So it was just, they still felt like they had to kind of apologize for having these, fanciful elements, which again, I'm amazed that they did Thor. Of all the characters they could have done, and of course in the next movie they did Daredevil, which was a lot more, human scaled. But it's like, that is such an ambitious choice that it's like, you could have done Captain America, you could have done any of them, but they chose to do one of the hardest characters to try and pull off. It was like, it's like, points for trying, guys.
Right. They did choose to do one of the hardest characters, but then again, they didn't really do that character. So, they boiled him down to his very basic imagery. I guess they gave him blonde hair and made him big.
I like his costume, like the browns and grays. Like it's just, it's like, okay, it's not a superhero costume. It's a Viking costume.
Right. And that made sense. And I can remember, watching it as a kid and being like, oh man, why isn't he wearing, metal trunks? But as an adult, that makes sense. Like that's a good choice. And they got the helmet. I mean, that's the important part. They got the helmet with little wings on it. And all things considered, I think the visually and just the way they chose to tell the story of these two superheroes, I thought was, good. I thought they did a solid job at it, especially given that, as you said, they did not have a roadmap. Like there was no place for them to look to find a way to do this. I mean, all of the superhero stuff was, like you say, it was another genre with superheroes sort of painted over the top of it in a kind of a ham-fisted way. Wonder Woman springs to mind as well, where she was, what any number of jobs it seemed like she had. And on top of it, then she would occasionally spin real fast and become amazing. That was just sort of what it was. And, science fiction for adults at that time, it was all Star Wars. It was all space-based stuff. So they needed to find a way to make it happen so that people would watch it. I don't know how – my understanding is the movie itself was very well rated, like got a better rating than the show ever did when it was on.
Yeah, it was huge. It was actually even a bigger hit than was even projected. It was a massive, massive success, and it led right to the next one. A year later, they had Trial of the Incredible Hulk on the air less than a year later. Which was
pretty, I was so excited.
Yeah, I remember that too. It was like, oh, Daredevil's gonna be on it. Yeah, it was very exciting. The sad thing is, you mentioned Mr. McGee, Jack Colvin. This is his last appearance because apparently he suffered some sort of minor stroke after he worked on this, and he basically retired from acting, and so they just retired the character, and you never hear from him again, which is a shame. I did like the whole idea that like McGee's career was kind of ruined because he was obsessed with the Hulk. Like, I think that's a fun detail that he was kind of considered like a crank and almost like they're like, oh, God, this guy with his monster obsession. I thought that was a nice thing. It's a shame that we don't get any resolution to it. He's just gone as of the next movie.
I mean, I would still to this day, like just sitting here thinking if they were to, you know, do that thing that they're doing now where they reboot things, but it's still a part of the original thing. Mm-hmm. If they were to do a She-Hulk TV show and have it be, you know, Bill Bixby's granddaughter or something like that, I would watch the hell out of that show. like I have absolutely nothing but love for, you know, that. And they did what they did, the Trial of the Incredible Hulk, and then there was a third one, but that didn't involve any other characters.
No, the death of the Incredible Hulk. And that was not even – they were apparently going to work She-Hulk into the death of the Incredible Hulk, and then they didn't. And then despite the title, the death of the Incredible Hulk was not meant to be the last one. They were actually going to bring him back in a fourth one called Revenge of the Incredible Hulk, which was going to have Iron Man in it.
No.
Yes, but unfortunately – and this is bizarre. Trial of the Incredible Hulk was a big hit. And then Death of the Incredible Hulk was a flop. Like, that makes no sense. I don't know why audiences were like, yay, for the first two. And then the third one, they were like, no, forget it. I don't know. So they never did a third one. They never did a fourth one. They ended it. The Hulk dies at the end of the third one, and that's it. That's the end of the story.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now, do you know any of the behind-the-scenes stuff as to why this happened? Like in terms of, you know, how after, what was it, 8 years or more, they were like, hey, you know what we should do? We should bring the Hulk back for a TV movie on a completely different network. Like, do you know what was going on there? Like, was that a push from Marvel or?
By this point, New Line or New World, I think, had bought Marvel. And so they had the rights to these things. And it's weird, the stuff with the way television works. Yeah, CBS, the Hulk was always a CBS show. And yet these ran on NBC. It's because, you know, CBS didn't own the show. It was New World owned it. And they could shop it around where they wanted to shop it around. So they shopped it around to NBC. It's always like why the MASH reunion special aired on Fox, even though MASH was always a CBS show. It's this kind of this weird thing with the rights. But no, I did some research and I could not find anything on as to why, like how this got started, like why they thought to bring it back. Why, you know, I mean, I know that Bill Bixby was always kind of pushing for it, and there was always the rumor that they didn't do a fourth movie because Bill Bixby had gotten sick. But that, I did read some quotes saying that that is not true, that the fourth movie was canceled long before news of Bill Bixby's cancer diagnosis ever came out, so that none of that is true. It really was that the ratings just weren't there for the third one. And so I remember the third one, it ends really sadly because the Hulk is in a chopper, and it explodes, and he basically falls and crashes down on the earth, and he then transforms back into Bruce Banner, and he says something like, I'm free, I'm finally free, and that's the end of the movie. And you're like, what a downer.
Right, yeah. That is definitely – that's like – that must have been made by like the German television network or something. Like that was – Das Hulk.
What's that director?
Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog, yeah. This is like Incredible Hulk is done by Werner Herzog. Yeah, exactly. Life is just on a landing stream of pain and misery, and then you die. Like, okay, thank you, Porter. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The one we'll never get to the death of the Incredible Hulk, I think, on this show, so it's worth talking about. The one moment in Death of the Incredible Hulk that really brought something new is in that movie, David Banner sees video footage of the Hulk, which is the first time he's ever seen his alter ego.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
I'm like, that's a great hook. Cause like for all these years, he just disappears. And then he wakes up hoping that the Hulk didn't kill anybody. So I thought that was a great little twist that he finally sees what his alter ego looked like. I thought that was a great little touch, but yeah, it is a shame that we never got, you know, I mean, we had such a sad resolution to this storyline because you really do. Bill Bixby was really, you know, he did a great job as Bruce Banner, David Banner. They don't call him Bruce, David Banner. And it's just a shame that, you know, the story wraps up in such a sad kind of way.
Now, do you know, it is a shame. It's a real shame. But it kind of, like, in a way, it sort of matches. It's kind of a nice bookend as well, because like we were saying, like the beginning theme of the show, the musically is this really intense, scary, kind of exciting thing. And then the end of it is that really sad music.
Right.
It almost preludes that, you know. It's kind of like, well, this is how it's got to end because this is how it ends. I'm sure that is not what they were thinking. I'm sure that's me nerd explaining to myself, but I like it. Now, do you know why they chose to use David Banner as opposed to Bruce? Did they just not have the big, you know, the big love for alliteration that Stan Lee has?
I think the apocryphal story is that they thought in the 70s the name Bruce had some homosexual connotations to it, and they didn't like that, and so they went with David. Yeah. I don't know whether that is true or not, but I've heard that story a bunch of times. That, yeah, because in the comics, he's Robert Bruce Banner, and then in the movies, he's David Banner. So, I don't know whether that story is true and whether that's something that just gets repeated over time or whatever, that's always what I heard, but who knows whether that's true or not. Again, as we've talked about, Kenneth Johnson wasn't worried about being true to the comic book roots at all. He didn't really care, so what the hell. But I love the Hulk was really the first, you know, ongoing comic book thing that you got on TV. You know, Spider-Man was an occasional show. Doctor Strange was just the one movie. Captain America, those awful Captain America movies did a couple of those. I mean, they had the Superman TV show and they had the Wonder Woman TV show. But I mean, Superman was kind of was before my time. And there was Batman and stuff. But the Hulk was kind of the only one that was airing as I was watching it. And I remembered watching it on Friday nights along with the Dukes of Hazzard, and it was like a big, you know, it was a big deal to like be able to see the Hulk every week. It was exciting.
Well, I think too, the other thing is, and this is something that, you know, always drew me to comic books, and you know, now comic book properties, is the Hulk, unlike the Superman television show, unlike Batman and Wonder Woman, I don't believe that they were geared toward adults.
No.
I think they were meant to be family viewing in the broadest possible scope of that phrase, you know, meaning lots of children were their target audience, whereas the Hulk was squarely for adults. It was telling a grown-up story that, you know, kids could watch from behind the couch, kind of like Doctor Who. That drew me to it, you know, as opposed to, I guess as a kid, like I remember one of the first comic books that I ever got wasn't a comic book at all. It was an Electric Company magazine, and it had a Spider-Man strip in the back of it. And I didn't like it because it's not that it was condescending to me. It was aimed directly at me, and I recognized that.
Right. Less words. So, right. Yeah.
Right. Less words, and it was, you know, I think he was, I don't know, maybe fighting Silent Ease or something. Something about it that wasn't – I didn't feel like I was looking in on something. I felt like something was being told to me, and I didn't care for it. And I think that that was true for me with a lot of those live action. It took me until I was in my 30s to like Batman 66. Like to truly enjoy it for what it was, to relax and be like, you know what, it can't be fine. That's fine. We're good. It's good. It's enjoyable. And it also took, you know, hours and hours of just horrible, grim, not horrible, but grim, sad, watching every iteration of every Batman lose his parents for me to be like, you know, can I just see Egghead for a few minutes? Like, not too much to ask, you know? So I think like the Hulk really spoke to me from that respect, whereas it was a show that I could look in on, you know, and see adults doing like, well, they weren't really superheroic, but, you know, that was the shorthand for me was that he's a superhero, you know, and that felt good. And I think a lot of kids respond to comic books in that way. So, you know, maybe that's why the Hulk had a longer lifespan than some of those other shows did.
Yeah, I think that's true. I absolutely think it's true. It had a kind of a darker, sadder cast to it. And when you're a kid, you kind of like that. You know, yeah, you're right. You don't want things that are aimed at at your age, you want a little bit older because you want to feel like you're a little older. And that's a, you know, that's kind of when I was a kid. I mean, I love the Hulk comic, but there was also the Black and White Hulk magazine, the Rampaging Hulk, which I just ate up because it was, it felt like it was more adult. It really wasn't because it was just all, but it just looked more adult. And I just, oh man, I love that thing to death. And then it was, they produced that because the Hulk was on TV. You know, it was like the Hulk had enough of a fan base that he could support a second magazine. So, I mean, I loved all that stuff. It was just so cool. So, yeah, this is, I mean, look, for anybody who hasn't seen The Incredible Hulk Returns, it's not great art by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm sure if you've been weaned on the Marvel movies, you will look at this thing as like the little Cowtown puppet show that it is. But
Cowtown puppet show.
But if you go into it with the knowledge and the forbearance of, hey, this was done, as you said, Corey, with no roadmap. These people had no idea what they were doing. They had no money to spend. It's a really noble effort. It really is. And
exactly.
I will always have an affection for it, despite all its flaws. I still kind of just have a soft spot in my heart for The Incredible Hulk Returns.
Absolutely. 100%. It's not something that's going to, you know, scratch that Avengers itch, if that's right. What you've got.
Right.
But, you know, it's a cool sort of like, you know, Sunday morning kind of, you know, pop it in and just see what was going on before you were paying attention. You know, that's kind of that's kind of the way I look at it. It's like watching the old serials for Superman or Flash Gordon or something mm-hmm. like that. Like mm-hmm. there's a time when things were a little more simple, and I don't mean that in a pastoralist kind of way, but just like they had to be because they didn't have, you know, these mind-boggling, you know, ideas and visual capabilities, you know. But at the same time, there's still going to be things you recognize. I mean, the plot of this movie is, you know, David Banner creating a light to warm all mankind. I mean, like, it is, that's it. You've seen that. It's the Avengers. This, you know, it's Tony Stark, you know, instead of David Banner. I mean, you've seen this, you know what it is. It's comfortable for you. If you give it a chance, you know, you'll probably like it.
Yeah. I'm very much looking forward to seeing Hulk and Thor together in Thor Ragnarok. This was a movie that, you know, I've seen all the Marvel movies in the theater. The Thor movies are my least favorite of the sets of franchises. I mean, I think they're fine, but they're my least favorite. And I kind of heard they were doing a third Thor movie, and I wasn't terribly excited about it. I was like, well, all right, I'll go see it, but, you know, whatever. And then I heard they hired Taika Waititi. I thought, well, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. And then I went and saw his movie, The Hunt for the Wilder People, which I think is terrific. And
oh, it's fantastic.
I was like, all right, well, okay. And then the trailer came out, and holy mac. And so now I am just, like, I am so excited to see Thor Ragnarok. I mean, it looks like Jack Kirby just thrown up on the big screen. I am really so does. Excited to see this movie.
It really does. And I don't know if you had a chance, did you watch the shorts of, like, Thor being, I think his name's Kevin's roommate.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
You know, I mean, yeah. Just fantastic. I love everything I've ever seen, like, Taika Waititi near.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm really, really excited. I don't find the Thor movies, they're not my least favorite. I think I like the humor in them, you know, and I like that they, you know, up until Guardians of the Galaxy came out, they really served as the exposition arm of the greater MCU story that were being told. So, you know, I knew where it was going, you knew where it was going, but it was nice to see it happen and to fit, you know, to click in all the pieces and, you know, figure everything out that was going on. So, I mean, I'm genuinely just very excited for this movie.
Yeah, and I hope that they'll do more of these kind of Marvel team-up movies. I hope mm-hmm. that they do more of that, of like, let's just pair up two characters. Let's put Spider-Man and, you know, Black Widow in a movie, and let's do Captain America. This is super fun. So I think Lou Ferrigno has a cameo in Thor Ragnarok. I heard that. And he's been in the other movie, so I love that there's always that through line. I think that's just terrific. It's a nice tribute.
How fantastic would it be if he was like cosplaying at a convention as the Hulk or something?
That'd be so cool. Oh my God, it'd be fantastic. So, that's the Incredible Hulk Returns. Corey, thank you so much for finally coming on the show, man. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time. And, of course, everybody, Corey will be back on very shortly. We have another movie that we're planning to talk about that is very beloved to both Corey and I. So he'll be back on the show sooner rather than later. So thank you for coming on, man.
Oh, absolutely. I had such a great time. I have enjoyed this every time I've done it. And to be able to do it with one of my best friends is fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. And so thanks, everyone, for listening. Go check out The Incredible Hulk Returns. It's on DVD, and it's probably – I think it's even on YouTube. I think the whole thing's on YouTube or something. So it's not hard to find. And by all means, go see Thor Ragnarok. By the time everybody's hearing this, Thor Ragnarok will be coming out, I think, within a day. I'll be seeing it over the weekend. I'm super excited to see it and finally be able to talk about it. So – of course, you can find back episodes of our show on the network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking about movies over on Twitter, which is @FilmAndWaterPod. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.